Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 268 for December 5 of 2014, talking design with the Motor City Master. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Jerry, how you doing?
Good, John. How are you? Long time no see.
I know. I haven't.
You been in California? I've been in California.
Yeah. Good thing we came back to the studio here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we should let everybody know, too, that we got Lauren Fix in the house with us tonight. Lauren, say a few syllables so people know you're really here.
I am Lauren Fix, and I'm thrilled to be here. It's a great honor. Gary and I have been chatting about this for a while, and happy to be a part of the show, and a big fan of Camillo's.
Well, that's the next segue then, because we got Camillo Pardo with us tonight, too. And Camillo, great having you on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here again. Last time it was for the Motor City Masters.
So we should explain for anybody who doesn't know, because we've got a lot of audience outside of the United States, too. So the Motor City Masters was a reality TV show where people competed against each other to do design projects. And you ended up winning the thing.
Yeah.
All right, but first, we should tell the people who don't know who he is.
Oh, yeah, because the Motor City Masters, that's what it's like.
I was a Ford designer for 24 years. Graduated from CCS.
CCS, College for Creative Studies in Detroit.
Yeah. College for Creative Studies. It's in Detroit. It has a very strong automotive design department. It was known as Center for Creative Studies for many years, but now it's a college of it. It was always a college. And recognized for the design of the Ford GT.
Was Homer Lagasse there when you were there?
Yes, Homer Lagasse was our instructor, and he was like a famous instructor. He was an instructor that had put many kids out, you know, through the college, and he was just this tremendous personality. I mean, he could have had his own show, you know, but I'm very proud and I'm very glad that I graduated under, you know, his education.
And you have become one of the legendary designers in this town because of one car that you worked on in particular.
Yeah, well, my studio was asked to take on the Ford GT project. That started in 1999, and by 2003, we had three cars for the Centennial. We did the concept car in 2002, and it came out into production in 05 and 06, which is now about a 10-year-old car. But
still looks gorgeous.
Yep.
Some cars will hold, you know, good shape and form like a good suit. I mean, you can buy one now with confidence that it's been well taken care of, and it's it can compete and perform with the best of today, with good tires and slight modification.
So, when you designed it, did you know intrinsically that this car would be what this car has become?
It had to. We were in a position where Ford was going to produce a Ford GT that was the follow-up of the Ford GTs, GT40s that won Le Mans. So the targets were to outperform Ferrari and look great. So we did our end in our studios to make it look as great as possible. And
in fact, it looked better than the original. I mean, about it, because the original was sort of cobbled together and everything. It just had to perform on the track, but... Mm-hmm. That's what knocked me out about your design, is it looked better than the original GT.
Yeah, well, the original car, I would say, came together kind of like a fighter plane. I mean, it was a series of shapes that were assembled because they were functional. And, you know, the skin was shrink-wrapped onto, you know, a fuselage kind of a thing with an engine that took in air, and it just looked great, like many airplanes do. And we took that and put contemporary design into it and tuned it, and engineering made sure that everything was working underneath, and they didn't go home until they met their targets. And, you know, like I said, if it looked great and didn't perform, it'd be a shame. And if it performed and didn't look good, that'd be a shame too. But we got both things going. That's probably why people still like it. And I drive one. I've driven one since 2005, and we all enjoy it on the track and across the country.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about? I mean, what was it like for them to come to you and say, Camillo, here's the project, dude?
Well, it trickled down, obviously. There was an engineer named Neil Ressler that...
Know him well, yeah.
Yeah, that he was friends with Bill Ford, I believe this is how it works, and he wanted to retire with a project like this. I mean, he was also heading up the Jaguar Formula One team, so he's a racing guy. And that came down to Jay Mays at the time, and Jay Mays brought it down to Tom Scott, who was my director, and Tom Scott's like, Camillo, you're the guy. I did the GT90 with Tom Scott, and mm-hmm. I had done another mid-engine car when I first started Ford. So in my short career of 24 years compared to some guys who were there 40, I did three mid-engine cars for what I called the sedan specialists of America. Some guys are there 30 years, they don't touch a mid-engine car. And now they're not the sedan specialists, they're the SUV specialists. But it's always like a family car kind of company. And to be able to be there that long and work on, you know, a handful of mid-engine vehicles is kind of out of the ordinary.
Was there something that you had designed that wasn't executed because engineering just couldn't quite make it work?
In which project?
Always. All the above.
The answer is yes.
Yeah.
There's always something that designers are doing that doesn't make it because of engineering or financing. I mean, we shoot for everything, and if you get 80, 85%, 90%, you're doing well, you know. Mm-hmm. I think we... You know, when I sat back, you know, and looked at it with my directors on that project, and he says, Camillo, you got, like, almost 90% of what you wanted on this car, so, you know.
Well, Lauren, you own one.
Yes, we own a Ford GT, and it's my second one, actually, red with white stripes, and it's a beautiful car. No matter where you go, people just are blown away that it's a Ford still, it's funny because you have a huge, and you probably know this, following online. There's a whole forum of people that have questions for you, that it's like following Star Trekkies. They're like super serious, and you're Captain Kirk. You know, you probably didn't know that. Maybe you do. But
Mr. Spock.
We can point your ears later. But yeah, the cars are great. And they're so drivable. And the rumor's always out right now that there's going to be another Ford GT down the road, and they're talking about that. I don't know if you've heard that rumor or you know anything further on that.
Well, when that rumor kicks around, it happened, I think, in 2011. Mm-hmm. Road and Track approached me, and they said, Camillo, what do you think it's going to look like? So I did a bunch of sketches for that, and recently Motor Trend approached me, and they says, we've heard this again. What do you think it's going to look like? So I actually go back and start sketching. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like another design project. But this time it's for a magazine, and I try to forecast where it could go, understanding where it came from, which is exactly the way the first, or the one that we did, is because we had to think about where it came from and forecast what would be cool for the future. I just got back from SEMA. I've heard a lot of things. I can't confirm anything.
Well, supposedly the new GT is going to be at the Detroit Auto Show in another month. And then also, supposedly, Ford's going to take it to Le Mans in 2016, which would be the 50th anniversary of them winning with the original GT40 Mark IV.
Yeah, I mean, I think the load is on the shoulder of the engineers, because no matter what it looks like, it has to perform to the level that has a track record. If it looked great and didn't perform, that would be a big problem.
Well, there's a lot of cars like that.
If it didn't look great and still beat them, or, you know, beat their targets, I think they could survive and overlook the fact that it doesn't quite look great. I mean, that's hard for designers to do. I prefer to be a slower car that looks cooler. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as you look at
a low rider,
as you look at the time from when you designed the car to speculating on what the car would be today or could be tomorrow, I mean, what intrinsically would there be different? I mean, what would you think would be a change that would be very immediately discerned?
Well, I think that it's about time to graduate from the retro thing and grow into a futuristic look, something that basically communicates, you know, that we are moving on to the future. And a lot of that can be influenced by racing. If you spent some time at Le Mans, you know, and looked at some of the vehicles that they're running there, obviously the GT was influenced by Le Mans anyways. the vehicles, the LMP1s, LMP2s, whatever they've been running, they, again, to me, I keep referring back to like a fighter jet. It's just a series of functional components, you know, integrated with a skin, and it's basically an anatomy of functional parts that are aerodynamic. And for some reason, when you get all that working together, something natural happens and it starts looking very nice. Just like human anatomy is very functional and it looks great. So I think it would grow from that. I think that sounds like the recipe.
I mean, would this be organic or would these be mechanical?
There's different approaches. Racing has gone through very geometric stages, and it has gone through very organic stages. I think right now it's in an organic form. I'm thinking Formula One, because they're trying to manipulate air, and the curves and the, like the floating fins and spoilers, they're all doing their job. You know, very much like some kind of high-speed, you know, bird or something that goes underwater very fast.
But don't you think that the current, this year's season Formula One cars are some of the ugliest that have ever been out there?
They change a lot, and it's hard to keep up with. I do like some better, some years better than others. I'd have to look again.
Yeah.
They change a lot.
They do. No, they do. And I just find that the current crop are some of the ugliest cars I've ever seen. Functionally, they absolutely work. But I like what you're saying is you want them to go really fast and look really good.
Yeah, that's usually the objective, you know, if you're, you know, putting the whole thing together. I noticed that the years that I worked there that engineering didn't always care. They just wanted it to, oh, yes, they wanted to look good, but it was just secondary. You know, they are always questioning, why do you need that? You know, what if it just came up an inch there? What if it went down an inch there? And it's like, I've got the whole thing balanced. It looks good. It's like, if you push it down an inch or two there, you're going to ruin the proportions. And they're like, you know, out the door with your proportions. We need more air. You know, we need more downforce. We need this. We need more room. But it's always a war, but I think that some of today's race cars look great. Every season they change. They usually change sometimes in the middle of the season. And I do like what some of the organic shapes were doing with Formula One. I was never a fan of the high nose, which is very strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you want to drive with your feet higher than your butt, but if that's helping it go faster, then whatever it takes.
What's your sense of the state of design of production vehicles today? Just what's out there from all the OEMs?
I think what's happening is the same thing that's happened for years. There is a recipe that works, and this shape in the recipe is holding Good aero, good package, good ergonomics, good comfort. And when you lay all these parameters out, it's almost like stock cars or NASCAR. They asked us to redesign a NASCAR in, at the Motor City Masters show. And they says, what do you think about designing your own NASCAR? And I was like, are we working in the wind tunnel? Do we have any flexibilities with your rules and regulations? If not, it's going to be exactly like the ones that you have right now. Right. There's no flexibility. So that's what's happening with cars today, is that they have like an optimum, you know, recipe of this is what, this is the best shape to contain all your functional bits and the people efficiently. So there's like an efficient shape. So what happens is everyone tries to do different graphics on this efficient shape. But that's happened through history forever. Way back when the first Testarossas, you look at the track and it's like, oh my God, all these kind of look like Testarossas. Right. There's one's an Aston, that one's a Maserati, that one's a Ferrari. They're all following the most efficient formula of the time. And as you go through the years, all the cars kind of merge onto the most efficient, you know, shape that is going through that time. And that's why people always say, well, the cars all look the same. Well, engineering and development has decided, and everyone's agreed, even the designers, that this is the best route. So all the companies are doing different versions of the best path. And that's why the cars usually look kind of the same. Somebody might get a little bit more clever than the others. You know, some may go with simplicity. Some may go with hard edges. Some may go with soft edges. There may be a good combination of all of it. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, how we can manipulate these graphics onto that shape.
So would a good designer break away from that and try to perhaps sub-optimize one of these things that is good in order to have something that is special?
Yeah, I mean, designers, you know, they'll go back to the board, sketch, and try to create a new groove, break through something. Maybe it'll be at a cost of a compromise in one area and take a beating for it and stand up for it. And or there may be a new development in engineering, and somebody catch wind of it first. Who's got the wind of it first, you know? Or, you know, I just wish, really, that today's people wouldn't mind sitting lower in the car. like people used to, because people like to sit higher. It's easier to get in and out of the vehicle, and that's what's making the cars kind of look like they do today, because if you didn't mind, like, dropping down into the seat, then your car is going to be a little lower, a little sleeker. But you have to be young and fit to do that. And, you know,
the baby boomer, boomer generation does not like dropping into a Corvette unless you're really an enthusiast, you know.
You have to be very excited, and you have to compromise your comfort. But once you're in, you're good.
Oh, I agree. I'm with you.
Once you're in, you know, and then just take your time rolling out of it.
That's right. Hey, we're going to take a quick break, but we got a million more things that we want to talk to you about.
Probably a bazillion questions coming in, right?
Mm-hmm. Is that going all right?
Yeah. Oh, it's great listening to you. It's like, why do I say anything?
No, but I like your questions. You guys have good questions.
We're enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. Legendary durability, impressive mileage, Firestone tires. So unstrap the saddle. These old stallions are ready to run again. Whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Probably sent you a couple of them.
You guys, if you ever want to do this at my place again, you're all welcome.
Cool. We'll probably take you up on that. Mm-hmm. Hey, before we get into the next topic, Ashley Knapp here, one of my colleagues, says, did you ever work with Jack Telnack?
Yes, I did. I actually knew Jack Telnack.
Jack's been on the show, too, by the way, but it's been a couple of years.
Yeah, I recommend him. He's a great guy, and he's got great personality. I knew Jack before I actually hired into Ford, because the automotive companies come to CCS to review the students and kind of forecast, you know, whether who they should hire. And they could see you developing from, you know, your second, third year senior. They'll grab you as a junior for an internship. So I knew Jack, and things worked out well when I graduated, and he hired me. Ford was a very, very kind of warm, comfortable, you know, atmosphere. General Motors was like the almighty, you know, polished, kind of cold, you know, place that you could go. But that was the mission, you know, to work for GM. But I liked the international quality of Ford. And Telnack was the guy running the whole thing. And it was great. It was great to work with him. And I keep in touch with him. We're friends.
And cool. You got to work in Europe.
Yeah, I worked for Jack in Italy a couple times, which was great. Italy's fantastic. I recommend it to everybody.
That's great.
If I'd end up waiting tables there if I wanted to stay. When you did the Ford GT, I know the heritage color at first was like, nobody wanted it. But now, as collectors, that is the premier vehicle to have. The color is the rarest one.
What is the heritage color?
The heritage is the Golf Team colors, which is the light blue and the orange. Was that your design, or is it something that Ford said, we need to go put a little bit of heritage into that?
That was just part of the history of the Ford GTs, the GT40s. It won 68, 69, not under Ford, but under John Wire. Mm-hmm. And those are probably the GT40s that everybody remembers the most, was the baby blue and orange. Baby blue and orange works quite well because they're complementary colors. And if you lay them out just right, it causes a lot of attention. When you pull up in one of these heritage cars, it draws a crowd.
Oh, yeah.
And there was only 300 of those made. It was a $14,000 option. And basically, it was the paint job and all the options of the Ford GT. I think there was only three or four of them. Mm-hmm. But that's a classic car to have. And if you have one with low miles, 1,000 or less,
big
it's
money.
Bringing in like $500,000.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, we watched the market, too. It's got on fire. I wonder at what point is it going to keep going. And if Ford were to produce another version of it, how will that impact the values? We don't know. It could actually hurt the overall values and flatten out what's going on.
I think that the Ford GT will just hold its own independently, the one that I worked on. And whatever they're working on now is, you know, is going to create its own atmosphere and its own strength. And it's going to be exciting to see whether they do a heritage kind of graphic. And they had to call it heritage because they couldn't call it John Wire. They can't call it Golf unless you and Golf were completely in on it together. And it almost didn't happen. The first year it was supposed to happen on our car, and I had it all. We had one painted baby blue, and I was ready to stripe it out and they say, forget about it, Camillo. And then, you know, a year later, they're like, get over here, hurry up, you know, it's on, you know, tape it out, you know. So I taped it out, and it went. So a lot of things have to line up. Mm-hmm. Will it apply? Our car looked like an evolution of the original car, so it totally applied. Mm-hmm. You know, when the graphics are laid on that thing, it is absolutely Le Mans. But I don't know what they're doing right now. And when I went to the Le Mans last to see the Ford GTs running for the first time in so many years, there was a Golf-sponsored vehicle, but it was Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. So there was Aston Martins in the Golf livery. Golf is, you know, making a presence in racing, has kind of had a comeback for years. So the Aston Martins were in baby blue, and those one was 007. It was kind of, I photographed
that'd be,
it.
That'd be the number to have, right?
You know, so, for I don't know. And Jackie Ickx was over there, you
no
know.
No kidding.
I wow. got to see him. I was looking for him.
Who won it how many times?
He won it twice with an attitude, which gave him, I think it's, you know, there should be a movie about him.
Yeah.
But I finally found him. I was waiting for him up at the suite, which was next to ours. And I was asking about him, and the guy goes, "Your hero, your superhero's coming up behind you." And I turned around, and there he was. And I ran right up to him and says, "Hi, I'm Camillo. I'm the chief designer of the Ford GT." And he said, "I heard you were around." And I said, "Look, I brought some vinyl. Will you please sign the vinyl? I'm going to apply it to my Golf GT at home." He says, "I want you to sign my car, but it's in America." So he's like, "How are we going to do that?"
Yeah.
He says, "Watch, sign this, I'll apply it, and I'll have your signature on my car." So it was cool. And I did a drawing for him of a GT. So it was cool to meet him. I mean, these kind of cars, they all come right back to the history of Le Mans and what's going on and the present, you know, situation of Le Mans. It would be great, you know, to see, you know, Ford back into it. And maybe even racing. I think there's a lot of people that would love to see Ford racing again.
Yeah, I'll raise my hand. I'd love to see that happen.
Me too.
Hey, let's go on to Motor City Masters, the TV show that you were part of. I've probably got more questions than we can probably squeeze in here in the next 5 minutes, but I was knocked out by the Camaro that you did, especially the rear end of that Camaro. In fact, I think on the show you said you did what every designer would love to do with this car, which some people might have thought is maybe a little bit arrogant, but I took it to mean that you're able to do things on this one-off that maybe you can't do in mass production. But I wondered, did Ed Welburn, the head of GM design, say, "Hey, Camillo, here's $1 million. We're going to put your design on these things"?
Yeah, I watched that show, and I would have loved to rephrase that part. But what I was trying to say is we did a rear on that vehicle that definitely was like what a designer would want to do. It was like a sketch. And I worked with Chunner on that. Mm-hmm. They brought him back. And
one of your colleagues on the show.
Yeah, he was one of the guys on the show that whenever I worked with him, you know, we came up with something good or we won. And I told Ed Welburn, I says, "Well, we only widened it like 8 or 9 inches per side." So I says, "Imagine if you walked in the studio and your designers told you that." It's like, "Oh, don't worry, we just widened it 8, 9 inches on either side."
So on the screen there.
Oh, that's the clay model. And they got on my case about the clay model. They says, "You're getting too Corvette. You're too Corvette with it." So I would recommend to people to listen to your judges, because they're like your boss. Yeah. They're like your design director. You need their vote. Right. So take their direction into your head and work it into something that makes you happy, you know, so that you're both, you know, on the same path. And it worked out. I remember Chunner getting a little worried. He's like, "Camillo, it's not coming together. Oh, my God, we're running out of time." And I go back there and it says, "Look, it's okay. It looks great. Let's just fill this in. Let's just do this and that." So the back end of the car, I think, looked very concept-like, like a concept car. And then we got very dramatic with the body side. I wanted to do some things, you know, that I've always wanted to do with a front-engine car, you know, like digging in really deep. There's a formula that works with front-engine cars, and there's a formula that works with mid-engine cars. And basically, front-engine cars, you're taking in air in the front, and you can pull air out of the front through the body side. And on the mid-engine cars, the other way, you're taking air in through the body side and then out the back. So there's some there's some things that you can push with the form, and it makes the form exciting. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping to make an exciting, sexy shape for the GM people to see. And the guys that were working on the car, doing all the Bondo, I mean, they made me do it too. They made all of us do it. But when they were sanding it, they're like, Camillo, if you get this thing done in time, you're going to win. They're like, this thing looks great. And it really, I mean, it's a sexy car. And they, obviously, they were on my team, right. But they says, it's looking better than Brian's, and Brian and I kept going back and forth looking at each other's vehicle. By that time, we were friends. Yes, we're competing, but things got different. Like the people that we're competing against with friction, they were gone.
Yeah.
Darby and Brian and I competed very hard together, but we liked each other.
That came across in the show, too. In fact, you could see when you two or any one of you two or three were paired up, it was like, all right, I'm so glad.
You and Darby had good chemistry. I mean, almost seemed like she was looking to you as like a mentor.
I was looking to her as like, a breath of fresh air and new direction. And she really was.
She's very talented.
And she would do stuff that was contrary to what normal designer would do. She would just ignore all the lines on the car and just go, no, let's go like this. And I'm like, really? And I said, that's out of the box and fresh. Let me see what I can do to work with that. And you'd have to be kind of closed-minded to block that out or to try to hold your ground because of your integrity.
So for those who don't know, were the guys who worked on your car saying that if you got this thing completed that you'd win?
Yeah, I heard that a few times as they were sanding.
And
we did. We won. But I don't think that it would be like it was by a long shot. I was, even to the last minute, especially when I listened to Ed Welburn describe why the winner won, I thought, man, I just lost. they're going with Brian's car from what he's saying. And when he said my name, it really freaked me out. Mm-hmm. And it's the first thing I've ever won. When you are chosen to do a design in a company like Ford, I was on the T-Bird, I was on the Ford GT, I was on several concept cars, and they select your car, your direction. It may be kind of like a game show. It's like, yes, I won. Well, not cash prizes. We are going to follow your concept. And that is like winning. But that's the first time I ever won anything, when it was on that show.
So it was a good experience? You like doing the whole show and everything?
Oh, yeah, it was a great experience. And I recommend designers to go on a show like that and take advantage of these kind of situations because it really puts you, in a position where you have to use all of your abilities. You have to exercise yourself and, push it to the, to the limit under a ridiculous time constraint. And it makes you grow. It's a real, checks yourself.
So when do we get to see what you're going to do for GM?
Well, GM,
because that was part of the winning. You got a contract.
A General Motors ambassador.
Ah.
As they described it. Now, I think they had the flexibility to take that to any level. Mm-hmm. I was a General Motors ambassador for this LA auto show. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even LA. What was that? The one in Encinitas?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I'm not sure what that one was.
Yeah, I don't know.
So that was it. That was my ambassador position.
So that's
you greeted people? Or
on, right?
Hi, I'm Camillo.
It's up to those guys. I'd always be happy and ready to do, work with GM. It was interesting, and I described it to the judges and Ed, that working on General Motors surfaces are definitely different than Ford surfaces. They have a different crown, a different tension to them. And if you really, really look at surfaces, you will understand that. I think that's why their Cadillac is so successful. I mean, I personally love that car, and a lot of the young people do. They captured that. And when you look at surfaces on the Mustang, they're, you know, they're a little bit, the new Mustang, they're a little more anatomical. Mm-hmm. So that's their vocabulary. That's their vocabulary. And you definitely understand it as soon as you put your hands on it and start modifying it.
Really interesting. Hey, it's been...
Ask them about design night.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Chip's reminding me here. We got to talk about your big bash party that you have as part of the Detroit Auto Show.
Well, we've hosted Designers Night for the last 17 years, and we're going to be going on our 18th. It is an event, a reception that we hold at my studio downtown in Detroit on my building on Woodward Avenue. It is an evening for the designers to get away from the auto show, come to a gallery, and look at some fine art. A lot of it's automotive fine art, but there's all kinds of art, and there's jazz and cocktails. And
Lots and lots and lots of people.
Yeah, we usually hold about 600-700 people. They may rotate. I heard one year it reached almost 1,000. But it's an event where all the designers can decompress, come to my place, relax, get away from the auto show, and catch up with their friends. Because, you know, there's going to be friends there that you worked with in Japan and Australia and Germany, you know, and they kind of like let their guard down, and now they're on neutral ground in my, you know, in my studio. And we always feature, you know, some cars, you know, some race cars, I do fashion design. I usually work on that throughout the year, and I send some models out wearing in my latest fashion. And I recommend it, you know, to all the designers, you know, when they come into town and need to get away from the convention kind of atmosphere, come, you know, to the party and enjoy a little jazz from Detroit and some cocktails.
That's great. Hey, thanks for coming on the show. And you're more than welcome to stick around, but we're going to get to some more of the other things going on in the business right now.
Oh, I'm curious.
Okay, cool. hang out. But Gary, you got to set this up because you were out driving the new Nissan Murano?
Yeah, Lynn Lauren was as well. We were both out there this week. They're launching. It's sort of interesting that Nissan says that they have introduced the 75% of their volume cars, and now they're working on the remaining 25%. The remaining 25% includes the Murano, it includes the forthcoming Maxima, and it includes the forthcoming Titan. So we talked to the Scott Pack, who's in charge of product planning for the vehicle while we were out there, and now we can't give any drive impressions, Lauren. So I don't
it's not
the 8th yet, but we can talk about the vehicle. But yeah. So we'll have Scott talk about what they're doing with the vehicle and some of the thinking behind it and some of the aspects of the vehicle that he thinks sets it apart from other crossovers.
Okay, Ben, let's go to that interview now.
Hey, everybody, I'm here in Caneros Inn with Scott Pack. He's the product planning manager for Nissan Crossovers. We're here to talk about the third generation Nissan Murano. Scott, good talking to you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So tell us about this new vehicle. It's all new. You guys have just top to bottom changed it up.
Yeah, it's an all new vehicle. It's the third generation Murano. Obviously, a complete redesign on the exterior and interior. So very excited with this new generation of Murano.
So it seems that the Murano in the crossover category has always had a distinctiveness in terms of the fact that it's looked different. It's looked a little more advanced. It looks as though it came from perhaps outer space. So you've continued with that theme for this vehicle. Has that been successful? Has it resonated among the customer base for the vehicle?
Yes, absolutely. The name Murano is derived from fine Italian glass, so It's a piece of sculpture. It's a museum masterpiece on the road, really inspired by supersonic jet travel and just the sleekness progressiveness of the modern design community. So yeah, absolutely, that's been appreciated and accepted by the consumer base as a vehicle that stands apart just by its just exterior presence alone.
So in the case of the new one, you know, you're talking about the aerodynamics, you're talking about the technology, you're talking jet-like, space-like. You guys have put much more technology in this vehicle than in the previous generation vehicle. Could you tell us about some of that technology and what it would do for the driver?
Sure. As fantastic as the design is for this vehicle, of course, it's a vehicle that customers have to live with and use on a daily basis. So in terms of technology, both personal technology as well as driver convenience and safety, quite a bit has gone in. It's an all-new IT system for the navigation. It's touchscreen, capacitive touch, icon-based with just like your smartphone or tablet. You can swipe, pinch to zoom, that sort of thing. There's a new 7-inch centimeter display right in front of the driver's eyes. It shows all of the relevant information. It's colorful, it's fast, it's very informative. There's a number of driver convenience features, such as the around-view monitor, which provides a 360 view around the vehicle. There are safety features such as the predictive forward collision warning, the emergency braking, intelligent cruise control, and of course everything from the heated and cooled front seats, the memory settings for the wheel, the mirrors, as well as the seat, which is a class exclusive, and just I can go on and on, but quite a few things that have gone into this vehicle to really make it competitive and stand out even further from the competitive set.
And we should mention that one of the reasons for the astronaut being here is the fact that you have these zero-gravity seats, and Nissan has been offering them in a number of vehicles
yes.
in the front row.
Right.
Murano's the first in the back row?
Exactly. So this is the third vehicle that's applying zero-gravity seats after the Altima and the Rogue. And as you mentioned, they are on the front row for those two vehicles. But now this vehicle, the Murano, it really resonates with the adult customers in the second row. So we've put the zero-gravity seats in the outboard positions in the second row seat as well. So you have four seats in the vehicle with the zero-gravity seats. Extremely comfortable, extremely supportive, reduces fatigue, reduces stress for driver and now passengers as well.
Now, with gasoline being less than $3 a gallon across the country right now, MPGs are not something that people are thinking about right now, but you guys have a pretty good MPG story on this new vehicle.
Absolutely. 28 miles per gallon on both front-wheel and all-wheel drive vehicles, which is almost a 20% improvement over the outgoing vehicle. For a vehicle of this size to get 28, that's very happy to see where that ended up. And right, gas prices are low relatively today, but probably will creep up in the future. And of course, as the customer purchases the vehicle and they look at a couple years down the road, that's when they'll really see the benefit.
But even though you've got this better efficiency, there's no sacrifice in terms of performance or drivability of this vehicle. You've added amenities. So what's the magic? How'd you do it?
I'm going to have to hand it off to our R&D community in terms of they've reduced some mass, they've improved the fuel economy, significant work on making the aerodynamics better, which with some additional sound insulation and a lot of things that went into the vehicle. It makes it quieter, makes it smoother, makes it ride better, it's a little bit quicker, handles better, and gets better fuel economy.
Total package.
Total package.
Scott,
absolutely.
Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Thank you.
I guess we're allowed to say that we like it or not. I think they did a nice job. It's much better than the previous generation. Technology, and we rode with the director of marketing, and Eric said to us, you know, that when they go to their design people, which is very interesting, they have two different teams. They have one in Japan and one here in the U.S., and when they put them out for people to make choices, they don't say where they came from. There's an interior design teams that compete, and the exterior design teams compete, and the American team won the outside, and the Japanese team won the inside, and you can sense that, and they blend nicely together, so I think they did a great job.
What do you think of the lines on that car?
Actually, when I look at cars, I think a lot about the lines, and I try to think about what the designers were doing, and I also think about whether there was a concept car before it. So it all goes in stages, and you don't want it just to be decorative, like I'm just trying to cut this pie into different slices. You know, you want it to be functional as well as visually entertaining. I mean, the lines look like a young designer did it with, you know, a lot of energy, and it looks like it may have been a spin-off of a concept car.
Yeah, it was actually the 2013 Detroit show, the Resonance, that they showed, and the Resonance was a hybrid, and this obviously is not, but I was looking at the pictures of the Resonance today, and they pretty much nailed it. I mean, it's
the Resonance was a concept car?
Yeah. The Nissan.
Okay, So it evolved from a concept car.
Correct.
It looks like it evolved from a concept car.
Yeah,
I mean,
especially that bump up in the rear three quarter.
Yeah, the bump up. Look at the way that the tail lamps wrap around. But there's a lot of the package that I see is trying to dominate the proportions of it. See, this is all very exciting stuff. The way it loops around back into the rear spoiler.
Boomerang taillights, I think they call them.
They called them what?
I think they call them boomerang taillights.
Boomerang.
Isn't that what was in the package? Yeah. Mm-hmm. You have to go with the terms.
And actually, from the speaking of design, we ought to get to some of the viewer questions here, but there's one thing I want to ask you about is that the designers that designed it at, you know, Nissan Design America, who, as Lauren said, ended up winning the contest, as it were. What they did in developing the vehicle was the designers, not the modelers, but the designers who were working on it made 1/10 size models out of clay. So they did quick clays.
Sketches.
But three-dimensional out of clay to see how it would look. What do you think about that as an approach?
That is the regular procedure, really.
Mm-hmm. You'd think something so small wouldn't really give you a sense.
They don't make them... Normally, they don't make them that small, but if you make them that small, you can try things very fast.
That's what they were saying, they were basically, you know, crude. I mean, because they made the point to me that, look, you know, we're the designers that are normally doing the sketches, but in this case, you know, we got the clay out and we molded it.
So they did little ones first, real small ones?
Yeah, and then they scaled it from there.
Yeah, well, when you do the real small ones, it's easy to... ignore the package a bit, you know, so go outside the lines, you know, push the shape, because it's hard to check the package continuously in that scale, so you're going to get really brave. But that's what triggers new directions, is when you get really brave and just erase the parameters for a minute and just, like, try something questionable. And if you do come up with a good geometry, a good shape, and it's out there, and then it's easier to take that good idea. It's easier to take the good idea and then bring it back than to stay in this box and try to come up with something. Like just go reach first.
Right.
You know.
And if it's crappy, you just throw it against the wall and start all over again.
Turn into a ball like Play-Doh and start over, right?
All right. John.
Yeah, we got a few more questions coming in from viewers while this has been going on. Dr. Botox wants to know, Camilla, what do you think of the new Miata? And a follow-up question, can you do small?
Like a small car?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think that the size isn't always, you know, the full answer to the car. I mean... you could put anything in a computer and scale it down or scale it up. Yeah. Like I was just telling you about, we were talking about the 71 through 73 Mustang. If you could put it in the computer and scale it down, I think we'd have a hot car.
Yeah, agreed. It's a little bit big.
Yeah.
So new Miata or MX-5? Any thoughts?
I think the new Miata is continually improving, but... It hasn't been something that is, like, for me. It's for other people, and I see it on the street. And it looks better and better all the time. So, great. I mean, I think it would have to... something has to change in that in order for it to be a car for me. You know, I'd rather be in a 550 Spider.
There you go. There you go. I'm with you there.
Cobra. I don't know, but that's me.
Yeah.
It's a great car for other personalities.
And VRM Chris wants to know, in your opinion, will Ford ever do an equivalent to the Corvette?
Well, I think we passed that up with the GT, the Ford GT. I mean, when we worked on that car and it rolled out, I said to my buddies, I think we just did the greatest American sports car. And I've been a big VET fan for years. To do a front-engine great car? Mustang's its own thing. Yeah. Mustang is a Mustang. Corvette's a Corvette. There's great Mustangs and great Corvettes. You know, some vets were better than other vets, and some Mustangs were better than other Mustangs.
But isn't the comparison, though, Camaro to Mustang rather than...
I would say it is. Yeah. That's a direct competitor. There was a seed in the formula way back when, like, the Thunderbird started. I think the Thunderbird and the Corvette were similar.
Right.
You know, they were the cool new shapes at the time in that point of history. And the Thunderbird could have evolved into a Corvette kind of deal, but it didn't. It turned into, like...
A Grand Marquis?
Well, I like the early 60s. You know, it turned into a Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra.
Well, if you're looking at like an F-Bird, which, you know, a big supercharger, that car had some power, but but you're comparing that to the Corvette of its era.
So that was Ford's front engine car that was great. Mm-hmm. Personally, I think, you know, Ford, you know, should have a Thunderbird. You know, I think Ford is a pickup, a Thunderbird and a Mustang. And now, you know, well, it's got to have, like, an SUV somewhere, so it needs four legs to stand like a chair. You remove the Thunderbird, it's kind of a shame. But, you know, I don't know, a lot of young people in the market today, they don't even probably know what a Thunderbird is.
Nope. Yeah. They don't know what a Grand Marquis is anymore either, thank goodness.
That's right.
And wasn't the Grand Marquis actually made at the same plant where the GT was made? In Wixom?
No, that was the Lincoln LS.
Ah, yeah. I want to say the Grand Marquis was made in St. Thomas, Canada, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
But the Continental was also built in Wixom.
The Continental was built.
So was
the Continental, the Town Car, and the LS were all built in Wixom, and the final assembly of the GT was done
there. That's where they...
But separate plant, separate building, you know.
Yeah, I didn't go to Wixom much until... Actually, I didn't go there at all until the Ford GT was involved, and that's where they were putting the engine in and fitting the interior. So it basically looked like a finished car when it arrived there.
Mm-hmm. Watch your mic. You're losing it. We want to hear what you're saying there.
Speaking of the F-150, there was the big news this week of Motor Trend named its truck of the year.
Yeah, what do you guys, Lauren, what do you read into that?
Well,
tell us what it is.
Okay, well, Motor Trend said that it's the Colorado.
Is the truck of the year.
The mid-sized pickup truck is the truck of the year.
The Chevy Colorado.
The Chevy Colorado. I was kind of surprised, actually.
I'll tell you what surprised me. They had nine journalists or staff members evaluating this truck. They said it was a unanimous decision. When do automotive journalists ever agree on anything?
Was it based on advertising dollars, or was it based on, I don't know.
And Scott Burgess wrote the story on the car. Scott was in the seat here.
I don't believe that anybody bought the award. I think that happened in the past, back in the 70s.
Right.
I don't believe that that's what's happened.
I can't believe that every journalist thought that the Colorado was the best truck that's new this year. You look at the F-150 and what they've done. It's aluminum, totally redesigned. It's lighter, and I do see a benefit. I mean, you can more towing capacity, better fuel economy. I mean, it looks great. My God, you can have massaging seats in it if you want to go all the way up and load it up. I mean, it's a great truck, and they're talking about taking that same technology and putting it into the Super Duties.
The aluminum.
The aluminum into the F-250, you know, the 3/4 ton and the 1 ton. I'm impressed with that.
I got to give a shout out to Ram PR, though, because shortly, within minutes of Motor Trend's announcement of the Colorado being the Motor Trend Truck of the Year, Ram announced that Esquire magazine named the Ram 1500 Echo Diesel the Truck of the Year.
I do love diesel.
Who knew that Esquire named
Esquire
Truck of the Year?
That's
about advertising.
You know, yeah, that is about it. Yeah.
You know, right. Penelope Cruz, the most beautiful, sexiest woman on earth. You know, I could see where Esquire is going down with
all
that.
All right, I'll give it that.
Yeah, I just thought that was
the hottest
funny,
guy.
Well, they're going to have like a really sexy cover shot of it.
Of the truck?
Of the truck.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
you know, Esquire's.
Right.
Yeah, I actually had a hard time finding it on their website. But
it was very deep.
I doubt Esquire's going to put a truck on the cover. I just don't see that.
Unless Scarlett Johansson's in some way associated with it.
Yeah.
Just guessing.
But, something like that.
Lauren, you mentioned diesels, how much you like them. What do you make of this?
I love diesel.
Me too. But what do you make of this move that France is talking about of phasing diesels out?
That's something they're talking about. They have a lot of other problems in the country of France than eliminating diesel, which is ridiculous because the price of fuel or diesel or petrol there is so much more expensive. So why take the most efficient version with the longest distance per tank and remove that from the marketplace and put a burden on its citizens to pay more for gasoline-powered cars? Makes no sense.
They have fleet trucks there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Tons of fleet trucks that drive on diesel.
Well, the cars do, too. I mean, it's very common in Europe to use diesel, and they want to remove that in France.
Well, some are talking about it.
I can't imagine that's going to happen. I think they have a lot of other issues internally in the government they need to sort out first.
All right. According to Reuters, 80% of French motorists drive diesel-powered cars. Now, we got to explain that the reason that diesel-powered cars became so popular in France had a whole lot to do with taxation, okay? So basically, you know, we have this discussion here of, you know, if you pick a technology and if you push it, well, you do that through taxation, okay? So if you're going to buy a Volt or a Leaf or something, you're going to get credits, right? So the French government did that. So they came to a conclusion that there may be fuel efficiency, but the pollutants that are being emitted by the diesels.
But it's so much cleaner now that there's clean diesel. Well, they put urea in the tank.
But there is the argument now that the particulates are very, very fine and are actually more carcinogenic. Seriously, I'm not making this stuff up.
They are. So you put on a particulate track.
Right.
And in fact, in the U.S. right now, if I got this right, I want to say that the particulates for gasoline and diesel engines are the same.
Pretty close.
In fact, in Europe.
Okay. But with their pushing, they're going to, the energy minister something Royale announced earlier this year that drivers scrapping diesel-powered cars to buy an electric one would be entitled to a bonus up to 10,000 euro. See, so there's the rest of the story. They want to push that. Well, but in France, there's a lot of
nuclear
nukes,
power,
right?
Which we don't have here.
And so I checked the price of gasoline and diesel as of November 21st in France I like this that here, you know, we consider premium to be 95 octane. There, it's 95 is regular, and it's 1.41 euro per liter for gasoline, and it's 1.25
for diesel
liter.
So diesel's more expensive.
No, diesel's cheaper, but I converted it. There's a 20-cent difference.
Well, it's,
per liter.
It's per 4 liter. If you're talking about a liter, 4 liters plus a
right. But I mean, but it's
makes
only,
an imperial
it's only,
gallon, which is
so
plus
it's,
a pint.
So it's 80 cents. A gallon difference.
Okay, well, depending upon what you're driving, that could be very expensive.
That's a lot.
And considering the fact that if they're having trouble with high unemployment, where are these people going to get the money to trade in their vehicles for electric vehicles? It's sort of like the cash for clunkers nightmare that we had here. Who benefited from that? People that had money benefited from that. People that are unemployed, they couldn't afford a new car, they didn't benefit from that. And the people that were smart enough to sell those cars overseas, they were the ones that made the real money.
People with money always benefit, don't they?
Or to put it another way, them that has gets.
Yeah. And then they gets more.
Yeah. Right. Richard Poor, it's good to have money, right?
Yeah. Hey, look, we're at the top of the hour. We ought to wrap this up here. But, Camillo, so awesome having you on here, man. I love your insights into design. I found that fascinating, especially what you were talking about, the surface differences between Ford and GM. I'm going to have to go out and touch cars right now.
All right, but Chrysler, you got to tell us before you leave, what's the difference between Ford, Chrysler, General Motors?
Well, I mean, I was a Chrysler guy growing up. I had my Barracuda, Roadrunner, Challenger. And I love those shapes. I think that the new shapes of Chrysler, I mean, They got everybody on the run, you know, with their sedans and 300 and all that. And I think that was probably the coolest things that they've done. You know, it has like this integrity of size and weight, I would say, in their proportions. But And then, you know, the Jeep thing, I think that they...
The Cherokee.
Definitely, they, you know, they've got that all under control. But when I'm talking about cars, I prefer, you know, the excitement that you see in, like, the Mustang and GM on the Cadillac. And I think right now the most exciting American car, if I had to run out and just get what I want, I'd be in the new Vette.
Yeah.
It is hot looking. Beautiful design.
It's a beautiful shape, great sculpture, the tailored lines, the organic shapes, the bladey edges. You know, we got the excitement, I think, that they held through the 70s with the classic, you know, Corvette. I'm a 60s Vette fan too, but they got that excitement back, and it's nice to see it on the road.
Good deal. So, once again, cool having you on After Hours.
Great, thank you. You know, it's nice to come out and see you guys, and you're always welcome back down to my studio.
Cool. Awesome to know. And Lauren, great having you here too. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's an honor. I'm thrilled to be here, and nice to chat with Camilla.
Good deal.
And Gary too.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lauren.
Cool. And Gary, good seeing you after a while.
Yeah.
Good deal.
Let's try this another time.
We should. We ought to do it. Want to thank everybody else for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.